Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, the implications of a recent wave of layoffs at Grand Canyon National Park.
And how Western comic books played into the perception of this part of the country.
But first, Stacey Iannacone is a photographer here in Phoenix. And for her most recent project, she decided to document some of the city's abandoned and derelict buildings. She calls her show Vacant Visions, and it's a series of images that show what Iannacone calls the city's silent decay. In one piece called Empty Tables, we see the crumbling remains of an old restaurant. Another, Last Time Card, shows the rusted out door to the employee entrance of what used to be a sugar beet factory in Glendale. In all of these images, the color scheme is a kind of haunting, luminous black and white. And the photographs themselves also have an almost curdled quality to them, which is the intentional result of the photographic process that Iannacone uses to print them. I spoke with Iannacone recently about her inspirations for Vacant Visions and what she hopes the work makes viewers think about.
My husband and I have a darkroom on Grand Avenue. And Grand Avenue, especially the section that we're in, it's sort of right before you get to the highway section, it's full of these buildings. And I see them every day. I'm down at the lab and we take photo walks and we look at them. And just day after day, you see them and you see no movement whatsoever in any of the buildings. They're just getting more graffiti. They're just falling apart more. Some of them look like they're about to literally fall over. And I just made me think, you know, they're interesting to look at, but at the same time, overall, the neighborhood always kind of looks like it's in the middle of blight and it doesn't look great.
I love the way that you just described that because it's, in a way, you're describing a stillness to these buildings in the sense that there's no occupation of them, at least no maybe legal occupation of them.
Yeah.
But there's also this dynamism to them in the sense that they're being reclaimed by these other things, whether it's graffiti or unhoused folks, whatever it is.
Yeah.
There's something to me about the photographs, and maybe it's the color scheme of them, but there's a little bit of a melancholy.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a sadness there. It's a sadness of, okay, you know, you can tell there was a lot of thriving businesses on this street at one point, especially down on Grand. Like, that's sad. What, you know, what happened? And where did those people go? And it just, the project that I'm doing, with the photography, the mortensage, the process that I'm using really matches up well with that feeling that you get.
Tell folks what the mortensage is so that they can kind of appreciate how that fits in.
Yeah. So basically in the darkroom, you make a silver gelatin print. So if you go to a museum or anything like that, that's what you're looking at when you're looking at photography traditionally, especially black and white. And in essence, you're destroying the silver gelatin print with the mortensage. It's actually a really fun chemical process that actually will destroy the print. And what it does, it takes the darkest parts of the print, the blackest parts, it'll actually lift them off of the paper. It loosens up the gelatin that's there, and it actually creates something called veils on there. And in some ways, it's uncontrollable. Other ways, you can control a little bit. For this project, my goal was really just straight up destroy. So the whole print went into this chemical bath, and I really just wanted to look as rough as possible.
What felt appropriate to you about it for this particular set of images?
It honestly, when I was looking at the buildings and thinking, man, I should do a project with this, and then I've been experimenting with mortensage now the last, I'm going to say, three and a half years, and I just love it. I just started thinking about it. I'm like, oh, my gosh, oh, I'm destroying the prints. I'm destroying them like the buildings are destroyed. I'm like, this is great.
Right. Yeah, there's this element where you are kind of perpetrating upon your own work.
Yeah.
The same damage that the city is perpetrating upon its own buildings.
Exactly.
But there's also something very interesting to me about the lack of control that you have over the process, because you can apply these chemicals to your prints, right? And then they do their chemical thing, and you don't really have any control over what the outcome of that is.
I like that. And I also don't like things being perfect. The world's not a perfect place. I see a print that, you know, it looks like it just came off a digital camera or a phone, and it just leaves me personally kind of bored.
Yeah, well, it makes me think you're treating these buildings, which are arguably dying, and you can't maybe, you know, as an art photographer, you can't necessarily save the buildings, but you can make these images that are living in some way.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I want people to look at them and really start conversations with each other. I'd love them to be reused. You see a lot of redevelopment in Phoenix with new.
Yeah.
And you see a lot of these buildings, and then you'll see a brand new, shiny, boring tower go up beside it. And then you have this building that's obviously full of character. It had a lot of love at one point. I've been here for 8.5 years. I came from the East Coast. And I'm used to a lot of history in the buildings. I'm used to a lot of time that makes things beautiful. And people are kind of, you know, you have an old building and they embrace that. You know, you go into, like, I had lived in Brooklyn for a while, and there was this building that was a CVS. And it used to be like some bank from like the 1800s that was like super beautiful inside. I'm like, what is this? I'm like, you know, even as a, you know, basic business being in there. And Phoenix just doesn't seem to do a whole lot of that.
Yeah. I mean, you've really unlocked a very interesting level of all this, I think. I moved here from the East Coast also from Brooklyn. And there is this thing that happens in a lot of East Coast cities. It's not just New York, where, you know, like, there is literally a Trader Joe's in Brooklyn where they have the salad greens. It used to be the vault where they kept all the money in this old bank.
Yeah.
And you could argue that it's sort of sad that this beautiful antique building got turned into a chain grocery store. But you could also argue that there's something very powerful about being forced to experience modernity in this artifact of the past. The erasure is not complete.
God, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, what's worse, having the CVS or the Trader Joe's in the bank, or having it totally torn down and having a really ugly square.
Right.
I'd take the CVS every day.
Well, it's particularly interesting in a city like Phoenix, where the original building hasn't even been there that long.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
like the cornerstone maybe says what, like 1954 or something?
Yeah, that's old here.
You know, as we're talking about this, I'm realizing, I think one of the unfortunate things about living in New York is that everybody there feels like they're an expert on New York.
Yeah.
And they want to tell you about, you know, if you're in the Trader Joe's that's in an old bank in New York, the person shopping next to you probably wants to tap you on the shoulder and be like, you know, we're in an old bank.
Yep, absolutely.
But here, there's a lot of people who don't even necessarily know a lot of the history of this place because, relatively speaking, there is so much less of it. And because it seems like, based on your project, there is less of an attempt to preserve what history there is.
Yeah. Yeah, like, I tried to do research on everywhere I shot, and it was hard. I had to just go in the city and look at property records, and then that wouldn't really even give me much. It was just like, oh, here's the owner. And there was a surprising amount of non-Phoenix residents that owned a lot of these buildings, but that's really all the further I could get. I was like, what's the history? And the only way you really know is if you talk to somebody that's been here for a very long time. And there's, unfortunately, not a ton of people. It's a very transplant city.
And you're creating a record.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, Stacey Iannacone is a photographer and an educator here in Phoenix, and we've been discussing her project, Vacant Visions. Stacey, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Last month on the show, we heard from the new Maricopa County Sheriff, Jerry Sheridan, about cooperating with immigration authorities, chronic understaffing, and his history as former Sheriff Joe Arpaio's chief deputy. The department is still under the eye of a court-appointed monitor who is charged with getting the department into compliance with a series of court orders aimed at making sure it doesn't discriminate against Latino citizens, as it was found guilty of doing more than a decade ago in the landmark case filed by the ACLU, Melendrez versus Arpaio. Sheriff Sheridan told me he did not agree with everything that Arpaio did, and he hopes to get the department out from under this expensive order. But our next guest says the leadership at MCSO has never fully acknowledged the harm it did to Latinos in Maricopa County and committed to truly overhauling its approach. Raul Pina is a longtime member of the Community Advisory Board, charged with overseeing MCSO's compliance with that court order. The board is independent and created by the court. Their goal, he told me, is to facilitate communication between the monitor, MCSO, and the federal court. I sat down with him recently in our studios to talk about the progress he's seen and if he thinks Sheridan can get them over the finish line.
So I got involved in the Melendrez case when I was an elementary school principal in Maryvale. And I started to hear stories of from children saying my mom was deported, my uncle was deported or detained. And I saw the pain in their face and the tears in their eyes. And I went to a community meeting at one of our schools, and I was immediately interested in trying to do something. I wasn't sure what I was going to do, but I volunteered through the ACLU to try to be to serve on the CAB, if you will.
Okay. You've been on the board for 8 years, a long time. And what kind of progress have you seen within the department in terms of trying to comply with this order, trying to make sure that they are not racially profiling Latino community members in any way?
I think we're still in a place where we don't have the will of the organization and the commitment to bring about this reform. It's different. A tune-up and an engine overhaul are very different things. And I think it's easier to commit to improving the system, tweaking the system, making changes. But I don't think there's been that acknowledgement that we caused a tremendous amount of pain in the community. We don't ever want to go back to that place, and let's uproot whatever is left. I don't think we're there yet.
So what are the requirements that you're looking at more specifically? Because they do get incredibly granular and detailed in terms of the measurements that MCSO officers are trying to meet to prove to the court that this is met. What are they?
The way I see it, leadership is technical. Leadership is symbolic. So there's some technical pieces that have to happen in the reform process. There's right. measurements and there's criteria that the judge will tell us ultimately, this is good enough. This has been sustained over 3 years. So that's important. The symbolic side of leadership, one example, when you have the new sheriff file a petition to the court at 4:30 in the afternoon to try to prevent a 6 o'clock community meeting in Guadalupe, there's symbolism there. There is something that is perhaps intangible, but it's huge. People are going to feel very uncomfortable when the new sheriff does that. So those are the things that are symbolic of where you are as an agency, where your leadership stands.
So there's the symbolic measure there. That probably feeds a lot into community trust.
Absolutely. People listen to the message within the message. For example, when the sheriff says, we haven't had racial profiling in 10 years. When we have, I mean, the MCSO Commission studies are telling us racial profiling exists. There's racial bias during traffic stops. That is there. The evidence is there. But for a sheriff to say racial profiling has not happened in 10 years, it does not exist, it's concerning.
So you're talking about something that the new sheriff, Jerry Sheridan, has said. But he also said, and he told me on the show not too long ago, that he disagreed with a lot of what Joe Arpaio was doing at the time, that he didn't think that they should be targeting Hispanic neighborhoods to do saturation patrols.
I think that's a nice sentiment to express, but it takes layers of leadership in order to sustain malpractice. So you have to, if you're going to create some distance between you and that pain that was caused to the community, I think you have to take a stronger stance against that. If you're going to say, I was not a part of that, you have to make a stronger statement. I was not a part of that, and here's why I was not a part of that, and here's the evidence of how I did not participate in that, and here's my commitment to the future. It's not enough to say I disagreed because you were a part of that system that enabled this malpractice to happen over decades.
So the rebuilding trust process is difficult, especially with somebody I'm imagining like Jerry Sheridan, who's coming in and who was Sheriff Joe Arpaio's chief deputy for so long. Do you think, are you optimistic that he can come in and get this court order under compliance, get this settled and kind of get the department out from under this cloud, as the former sheriff called it?
I think we can be cautiously hopeful or cautiously optimistic about this. Everyone deserves an opportunity. I think he will have his. I would encourage the new sheriff to spike the football in the end zone. He is closer than they've ever been to come into compliance and to sustain compliance, which is another key aspect of this order. But I would hope that he spikes the football and lets the previous sheriffs know that he did it. He brought us into compliance. He eliminated racial profiling. That would be great. And I would be the first one to give him kudos for that.
Let me ask you about what this looks like in the community there. You mentioned being a school principal in Maryvale for a long time and the kind of experiences you heard from kids there. Is it still true today that you think people within the Latino community in Maricopa County are hesitant to call MCSO or are suspicious of it, especially given kind of the current environment we're now under where we're seeing mass deportations being carried out again?
I do believe that is the case. The fact is that there are folks who are in mixed status families, might be going through the process of securing their DACA documentation and so forth. So they are more vulnerable than I am.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a Hispanic vehicle operator, but I also have veteran plates. I live in a suburb. I have an incredible amount of privilege in my role as an educator. So my traffic stop will look differently, perhaps, unless I'm traveling with someone in a mixed status situation. So I think we have to be sensitive to the most impacted people. It's not enough to say, I met with the consulate. I met with CEOs from the charitable organizations. I've done this handshaking and kissing babies. It's not enough to do those things. We have to listen to the most impacted people and how do they feel. My experience has been in listening to some of those conversations in meetings, the fear is very much there.
Hmm. What kind of impact did the former sheriff, Sheriff Paul Penzone, have in terms of the progress of this court case, from your perspective at least? Like, he left office sort of saying, you know, I'm spending more time investigating my own sheriffs than we are investigating crime in the community, that kind of thing.
It's unfortunate that he abandoned his post and left without seeing this to the end. He had some time left to continue progress towards reform, and he didn't do it. That's his choice. You'll have to live with that. What they did in the time that Penzone was there, they started moving towards compliance. Mm-hmm. Kudos to them. Some of that was low-hanging fruit. Some of that was what we call paper compliance. They started developing training manuals. They started developing data collection systems and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
The challenges are in the interactions at the traffic stop, right? That's where the racial profiling was still being reported. So those things still lingered throughout Penzone's time as a leader there. Unfortunately, he left, and kudos to Sheriff Skinner while he was there. He
mm-hmm.
was also,
the interim, yeah.
Not only was he the interim, but he was also very much involved in the progress under Penzone that happened. He was in the trenches. He was helping move the process forward. So I think key people have brought us closer to compliance, and I think we're closer than ever. I mean, we have the opportunity to see it through.
All right, we'll leave it there. Raul Pina serves on the Community Advisory Board overseeing the court order compliance. Thank you so much, Raul, for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
We also reached out to the sheriff's office about that community meeting in Guadalupe that Pina said Sheriff Sheridan attempted to postpone at the last minute when he first took office. A spokesperson told us he made that request because the meeting fell on a national day of protests when protesters called for action at the meeting. It followed a night of protests in Glendale in which a police cruiser's window was smashed in. With all these signs leading up to the meeting, the sheriff's office said we wanted to keep everyone safe. We also reached out to former Sheriff Paul Penzone for comment on this. We have not received a response.
Among the federal workers that have been laid off in the first several weeks of the Trump administration are an estimated 1,000 National Park Service employees. That includes some at one of the country's most visited parks, Grand Canyon National Park. Adrian Skablund, a reporter and producer at KNAU in Flagstaff, spoke with one of those employees who was let go. He joins me to talk about what he found out. And Adrian, what did this now former employee say about how they found out they'd lost their job?
Yeah, so they were actually in the field. This all happened, a couple of weeks ago. They were let go on Valentine's Day, like so many others. And they were in the field. And so they were actually, I think they got a call from their supervisor letting them know, because they had missed the email that so many others had had received. They worked on the project that the park is has been working on, the waterline project to repair the Trans Canyon waterline, I should say, and we're actually planning a project or planning that next day to head into the canyon to start planting trees down at the bottom of the Grand Canyon as part of an effort to plant vegetation, restore vegetation within the campground there at the bottom of the canyon near Phantom Ranch. So,
was this employee one of those probationary? Like, were they fairly new in their job?
Yeah, so they had been only working for the Grand Canyon National Park in a full-time position for about 6 months. But they had worked for 2 years in seasonal positions for the Grand Canyon since about 2022. So they've had a relationship with the canyon. They've seen the canyon and seen the park and the park service as, you know, their career steady work for them. But they were just working seasonally, like a lot of folks do. Flagstaff's a kind of a hub for science and a lot of kind of canyon related industries. And so it's not unusual for up here that folks will work seasonally in one way or another, whether that's for the, you know, Park Service or another federal agency, before moving into a more permanent position, if that's something that they're, you know, hoping to do.
Yeah. Well, so what did this person say about what they plan to do? I mean, this sounds like somebody who is clearly dedicated to doing this kind of work. What's next for them?
Yeah, they're not quite sure. They're hoping to get their job back. They like a lot of folks that I've talked to have said that they want to fight to get their job back. That said, they also have bills to pay. And I think it's not quite clear how long or what the process is going to look like for these folks who have lost their positions. He lives in park housing up in Grand Canyon Village. So his housing is tied to his job. So he's not quite sure how long he'll be able to stay there. His partner actually worked for Glen Canyon Recreation Area about 130 miles north up by Page on the Arizona-Utah border. 2 days after he was laid off or his job was terminated, you know, she called him and she had, you know, the same thing had happened. She had been terminated.
Well, so in addition to sort of the human impact here, what might the impact be? What are folks saying about what the impact of people losing their jobs will have on the park itself and park operations?
Yeah, so, I mean, what we know now, and I should note that Grand Canyon National Park and the Park Service have not answered really any of our questions. We've been told by local officials that 10 people were laid off from Grand Canyon National Park, but that's not coming from the Park Service. So in terms of impacts to the park, you know, we've seen many days since these terminations, longer lines at the south rim of, or the entrance, I should say, to the south rim, right by Tucson. Mm-hmm. You know, we've seen lines that are about double the length that they, you know, normally are. That's not every day, but it's certainly, you know, an increasing trend of longer lines. And then obviously this Trans Canyon water line that supplies water to the south rim of the Grand Canyon, it had been under, I guess it still is under this project. They're trying to fix it up and really retrofit it. that project appears to be on hold. That's a $200 million project that, you know, has been years and years in the making. It's pretty common up here to be hearing about breaks in that line or in that water line, which, you know, forces Grand Canyon officials to implement water restrictions.
Yeah.
And that means that, you know, the faucets that tourists rely on are not always able to provide water on these hot trails. So that's definitely one of the impacts that we've seen so far. I think it's also unclear of how these impacts. I mean, we're going into the spring break season, obviously is coming up. Summer season, Grand Canyon sees you know, huge amounts of tourism. It doesn't appear like this is going to change that necessarily. And so folks will be managing this park, managing this landscape with fewer hands. The National Park Service was approved to hire about 7,700 seasonal workers, but I talked to a man named Bill Wade. He's the executive director of the National Park Rangers Association, and he says that it might be a little bit too late. I mean, you'd really be wanting to hire these seasonal folks already, and these parks are already, generally speaking, they're already not fully staffed. You know, the number of permanent park employees, I think, has fallen about 15% over the last decade. So we're talking about parks that are already kind of stretched.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. That is Adrian Scabaland with KNAU Public Radio in Flagstaff. Adrian, thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. Great to be with you.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. For the last few weeks here in Phoenix, we have seen thousands of baseball fans descending on the greater metro area to watch spring training games. I know the eagerness of that kind of baseball fan very well. I have been that baseball fan, both here and in Sarasota, Florida. And not everybody understands the impulse to show up for what amounts to a series of scrimmages, where there's nothing on the line other than a collective hope that your favorite player doesn't get injured before the season even starts. Some would call such a fan a nerd. I would maybe go with something like connoisseur, but either way, I can appreciate that it's a little ridiculous to pay good money to watch games that don't really count. But down in Tucson this week, there is very meaningful baseball being played, namely the qualifying tournament for the 2026 World Baseball Classic, baseball's version of the World Cup. That means that the national teams from Brazil, China, Colombia, and Germany have been battling it out all week long. The winners will advance to next summer's World Baseball Classic. Michael Clare is a reporter for MLB.com, and he has been on the scene in Tucson all week. He joins us now. Michael, good morning.
Good morning, guys. How are you?
Doing very well. Thank you for being with us and giving a perspective on this really exciting event that I think a lot of people don't know as much about as maybe they would like to. Let's start with what we know so far. It's been a big week for Colombia and a not so great week for China.
Yeah, that's a pretty good way to sum it up. I mean, Colombia came here. They were a little upset that they had to come back to the qualifier, mad at themselves, really. And so they went and outscored their opponents 23-1 across the three games. So really, if Colombia was on the field, nobody else was having a good day. China went 0-3, and now.
Oh, and it looks like we may have lost Michael there, but I think I know what he was about to say, which is that in going 0-3, China unfortunately was bounced from the tournament. We are going to see if we can get Michael back on the line, and we'll be back in just a moment. And we are we back on the line with Michael? Looks like we are still struggling to get Michael back on the line down there in Tucson?
No, not back.
Oh, and there he is.
There we go. Sorry.
No worries. I have to assume you were distracted by a gigantic fly ball that drove in several runs.
But of course, that's where it's always at. So I'm not sure where we got cut off.
No worries. Yeah. You were talking about the dominance of Colombia, the opposite of dominance from Team China. But You know, something I really wanted to ask you about, Michael, is in addition to reporting on the play-by-play down there, you've been uncovering these really interesting storylines that are very different than the kinds of things we'd see at Major League spring training. And one of my favorite pieces that you wrote this week is about a guy named Osvaldo Carvalho. Tell me about Osvaldo.
Yeah, so he has a really unique background. You know, the Brazilian team, they don't have any current major leaguers on the team. There's some in the minor leagues. There's some that have, they have coaches that have played in the major leagues. They have players that are playing professionally in Japan. But most of them have at least at some point been a professional player. For Osvaldo, though, he is a construction worker. He plays in the local league in Sao Paulo. He started doing construction work during COVID for money, but also to continue practicing because it costs money to have access to these facilities. And he's done so well and he's so likable that he is on the team. And he got his first start in the final game against China and he picked up two hits and an RBI.
So cool. So cool. And again, just the kind of thing that you wouldn't see at Major League spring training. Speaking of which, another story that you've been following is the work of Jaden Agassi, who is the son of tennis legends Andre Agassi and Steffi Graf and is playing for Team Germany. His story is pretty impressive, but there was also a little nugget in your report on him that I loved, which is that in Europe, tennis is a major pipeline to baseball. Is that right?
Yes. So it's not too uncommon that if you're a tennis player, that at some point you might come across baseball and those skills transfer really easily. Pavel Hadim, the national team manager of the Czech Republic, he did not start playing baseball until he was a teenager, but he played tennis so that when he came over to the sport, he had a lot of the movements down. You know, his backhand was pretty similar to a swing. So it wasn't, you know, sometimes you'll see some of the members of the German national team a couple of years ago went to the Hertha Berlin soccer team and had them swing and it looked terrible. If you're a tennis player, you can come to the game and you'll still look pretty good.
Well, just about 30 seconds left here, Michael. And I want to ask you the last but not least important question, which is that I believe I saw on social media you recently had your first Sonoran hot dog. What is your review?
Yes. So I went to Jason's. I don't know if that means anything to people in Tucson. I loved it. I love beans. This one had beans. I loved the jalapeno hot sauce on top of it. That's a top-tier hot dog. That's a hot dog that is actually a meal and not just a little nitrate-loaded snack.
Well, lots of new experiences happening down there in Tucson. Michael Clare is a writer for MLB.com. Michael, thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. When we think about the genre of Westerns, many of us think about movies or TV shows or maybe even ads. But our next guest has researched and written a book about a different form of media, the Western comic book. Will Grady is author of Redrawing the Western, A History of American Comics and the Mythic West. I spoke with him earlier, and we started with what Western comics entailed, how prevalent they were, and how similar or dissimilar they were to other media depicting the West.
Yeah, so I'd say they kind of, this is the odd thing, because in the study of sort of the Western, everyone, as you say, sort of, there is all these dominant kind of media, sort of the films, the television and so on, but no one was looking at the comic books, and especially in the sort of the mid-century, the 1940s and the 1950s especially, Western comics were printed, American Western comics were printed in the were read by millions of people, mainly largely children. And I think that's why it's so interesting, and children and adolescents, I should say. And that's what makes it so interesting, is because this is a uniquely sort of young person's Western space. And so they were doing things that just film and television just weren't doing. So it might have been that they were sort of, they had these sort of very politicized stories, again, speaking very much to a young people that were reading these. Or it might have been that they're just, you know, a sense of fun. You know, Western comics or comic books in general, the stories were typically told across sort of, you know, 8 pages, you know, very short, sort of snappy stories. So it kind of had to condense all the action and all the fun and the frills that comes with Western adventure into just a small handful of pages. And I think that's what makes it that, like, for me anyway, and I'm sure for lots of other readers, that's where the enjoyment derives from. It was almost like you cut out all the boring, talky bits of a Western film and it's straight to action and and adventure.
Yeah. Well, so in terms of the imagery, is it what we would imagine or recognize from, you know, movies or TV shows, you know, a cowboy on a horse in a hat and, you know, beautiful landscapes and buttes and dusty, you know, dusty ground all around?
Of course, it's got all of them bits to it. And I think and so that is part of the kind of the appeal, because it's all what we're familiar with. All these Western heroes had their own comic book adventure. So it almost extended sort of people's kind of experiences with these sort of characters in a way.
Was that sort of the heyday of these comics, sort of the middle of the last century?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So, the superhero, because everyone, when you think of comic books, you naturally think of sort of the superhero. But after World War II, the superhero kind of declined in popularity. And that's where the Western took over as the sort of main central sort of adventure genre. So they were printed, there was thousands of different comics titles and read by, you know, millions of readers. So that was the sort of the key sort of height of popularity, but so was the height of popularity in film and other sort of media as well. They did resonate and they were so popular in the sort of mid-century, but the Western comic has been around for literal decades or centuries even.
Wow. So it's interesting that that was sort of the time when they were the most popular, you know, the middle of the 20th century, because that was sort of the beginning of big population booms in, you know, in Arizona and other parts of the West. And when, you know, the West sort of as it had been known was changing a little bit into the West sort of as we know it today.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think there's always been an element of nostalgia with the Western. I mean, it came about with the dawn of cinema at the turn of the century. And it was always that thing of looking backwards to a past that no longer existed. But I think then by the sort of mid-century, it's almost like it's been sort of some of them sort of referents have been taken away. And it's just a kind of fun, you know, adventure genre. But there was always the sort of the underlying kind of elements of triumph. It is that story of American triumph against a sort of an opponent. Oh gosh, for want of a better word, obviously the rugged frontier, the landscapes that were inhospitable, and the way that they went out and they sort of was able to expand across the nation in that way, across the landscape, shall we say.
So you mentioned that these stories were in many ways political. What kinds of messages were they trying to get out? What kinds of stories were they trying to tell here?
And that is a very huge part of the book because it travels through such a long period of time. I mean, again, if we do focus so much on the sort of the mid-century, I guess you could sort of look at the kind of, for example, there's a Western film called Colt 45, and the storyline is a film from 1950, and it's about the story of, you know, keeping a dangerous weapon, which is, of course, the Colt repeating pistol, out of the hands of the wrong people, which is obviously the outlaws, the villains. And of course, this is completely a code for the atom bomb,
right,
and keeping the bomb outside of the hands of those villainous Soviets. And so where film were kind of using a bit more nuance and a bit more sort of subtle allegory, comic books tended to be a bit more on the nose. So in the book, you'll see examples of sort of an indigenous character who in the 1800s is threatened by a group of Russians. And one night he has a nightmare about Joseph Stalin and realizes that he has to get the Russians off the continent before it's too late, because in the future, communists will be a threat to America. So there's lots of sort of really wacky kind of stories and you know, storylines about Soviet spies in the frontier and in the West. But then in other ways, they kind of, I mean, because that shifts so much over time. So obviously in the sort of 1960s and 1970s, the Western politically sours, you know, it becomes unpalatable for audiences in the face of things like the Vietnam War. And so again, you get these sort of storylines of kind of, it shifts these sort of the imagery of the kind of the triumphant, you know, cavalry, the knights in shining armor, and you get these sort of rampaging military men and things. So you get these subversions of the Western, very much like you do in sort of cinema as well.
So I've got to ask about your interest in this genre, because as folks back in the 1800s might have said, you're not from around these parts.
So, yes, no, funnily enough, it's a story about Arizona. And I actually visited there with my parents in 1998,
Okay.
and we went to Williams and we took the steam train to the Grand Canyon. And of course, I don't know if anyone as listeners or yourself have rode that train, and of course it gets stopped by bandits, and it's all very good fun. But it kind of it, the thing is like my memories of that I mean, so of course that was a bit of fun, but the actual landscape itself is so arresting, and my memories of these sort of vast desert landscapes are so, for want of a better word, exotic. There's like nothing I've ever seen before, and I think, yeah, it's something that always inspired me. I think for us as outsiders looking in, I think it's always been very appealing for sort of foreigners, for want of a better word, as Europeans, perhaps not a European anymore, damn. Yeah, the Western is it's just this place, and the sort of simplicity of the images of, you know, the wandering figure on that desolate sort of vast desert landscape. It's always sort of inspired something in me, and so then it was kind of like, when I got to university and I realized, oh my God, we can study comics. Wow. It was kind of, I realized there's multiple histories of the Western in film, multiple histories of the Western in television, fiction, painting, classical music, but where's the history on the Western comic?
Will Grady is the author of the book Redrawing the Western: A History of American Comics and the Mythic West. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.